The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. Today, two guests. The second guest, Dr. Henry Grayson, will talk about why we're so confused about the idea of love in our society, what we do in the name of love, how we manipulate people in the name of love, how we're hurt in the name of love, and how we can understand what is true love, where there's no confusion, complications. We'll deal with that. My guest in the first part of our program, we were going to have the other day, but weren't able to. Today we will. Thomas Fredrickson is a trained, licensed clinical psychotherapist, psychologist, and he's been working in the mental health profession. And then he began to study alternative medicine, and he was suffering from severe asthma, and he commenced with a study about asthma treatment founded by a Russian medical researcher, Dr. Buteyko and Dr. Novoselov in the 1950s, and researched at the Leningrad Institute of Pulmonology. And he then made the decision to learn the methodology under an intensive program in Moscow. And along with his wife, Sasha, director of the center in Woodstock, New York, where people are instructed in this natural method of specific breathing patterns to treat asthma and other illnesses, we'll talk to him about the Russian Buteyko method of treating asthma. Then, I believe an important original commentary I'll be doing. I was up last night till the wee early hours this morning writing it. This will be a conversation with Ed Schultz, Rachel Maddow, Lawrence O'Donnell, and others who have supported, rather uncritically, the invasion of Libya. My own thoughts, and then an opportunity for you to share yours on that, on our issues. Then the latest on health and nutrition, and for those of you who've been concerned that, well, we're told repeatedly that there is no problem with the flu shots, that they are not an issue at all. Now comes the latest study. A new study, quote, verifies mercury in flu shots are toxic. So I'll give you the latest on that, plus other information from the cutting edge of health and nutrition, including the medicinal advantages of papaya. Let us begin with my guest on the line now from Woodstock, New York, Thomas Fredrickson. Nice to have you with us today, Thomas.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's an honor to speak with you. Your personal contribution is extraordinary, and I'm very pleased to get a chance to share some time with you.
Thank you. We have many people in this audience who are in the healthcare profession and those who see firsthand the adverse effects of unhealthy lifestyles or environmental impacts, such as school teachers looking at their children and seeing obvious symptoms of what's wrong in a child, but not always knowing how to help them. So your segment is devoted to educating us as to how we can help with something as problematic and frequently as deadly as asthma in children and adults. So the first issue I'd like for you to take us on is the relationship between this imbalance of breathing, in particular hyperventilation and the onset of asthmatic symptoms, and then from there, what are the particular chemical imbalances, particularly with CO2 and nitric oxide levels, and the natural body cycles that are most affected by improper breathing patterns associated with asthma? And I guess you would have to start by saying what is proper breathing and what is improper breathing, since most people never stop long enough and think, I didn't know there was a difference.
Absolutely. Well, I will quote Lao Tzu first, who in the 5th century said, the perfect man breathes as if he's not breathing at all. What Dr. Constantine Buteyko discovered is that chronic hyperventilation creates such a physiological train wreck throughout the body that, in his opinion, it is the major cause of disease. Now, what Buteyko realized is that as we all chronically hyperventilate, we lose carbon dioxide. That's triggered what's called the Bohr-Verrigo effect. And the oxygen that is in our hemoglobin is trapped in the hemoglobin. The oxygen requires a molecule of carbon dioxide to get loose and to move into the body. So the body becomes hypoxic. It becomes oxygen deprived. So the bronchospasm of asthma is a defense mechanism. And when it is treated as it is commonly treated with medication, it's relieving the symptom, but it is not changing the cause. When you change the breathing pattern, you no longer trigger the bronchospasm. You also do not trigger hypertension. Buteyko himself had hypertension and discovered the method by literally asking the question, is my hyperventilation causing my hypertension, or is my hypertension causing the hyperventilation? He reduced his breathing, dropped his hypertension. He then went to another part of the hospital and had asthmatics reduce their breathing patterns.
Okay, then let's take that further.
Yes.
Summarize the particular breathing method and give us the scientific rationale behind why it's effective. And are there certain types of asthma or asthmatic conditions associated with certain causes that would be more affected than others?
Well, let me answer the last part first. It is extremely effective with all types of asthma. Now, what occurs is when you overbreathe, you lose carbon dioxide. That's the Verrigo-Bohr effect. And the oxygen is trapped, as I had said, in the hemoglobin. Therefore, the whole body is deprived of oxygen. And the body fights back by a number of different methods. Buteyko called carbon dioxide the angel's wing over the body. One of the defense mechanisms is bronchospasm. Another defense mechanism is hypertension. Now, when we do not have adequate oxygen in the body, that, of course, triggers the fight-or-flight response, which triggers more hyperventilation. But, for example, the kidneys, without adequate oxygen, improperly release potassium, magnesium, and bicarbonate. And as those elements leave the body, those elements are necessary for ATP and ADP, cellular energy. As those elements leave the body, they hook onto iron, and the body becomes iron deficient. And Dr. Buteyko did not believe in many diseases, such as AIDS. He felt that the issue of AIDS was caused by the weakened immune system caused by the chronic hyperventilation. And his work is...
I would consider that a gross oversimplification, and I would challenge him on that principle because I've worked with probably 2,200 people who have AIDS-defining illnesses, and it was not their breathing that was the problem. It was their exposure to multiple viruses and bacteria and sexually transmitted diseases and imbalances in bacteria in the intestine and thrush. So we'll set that aside and not argue that issue today. I want to focus upon what we can absolutely prove scientifically about breathing and asthma.
Excellent. All right. Thank you. Buteyko's whole field was the weakened immune system was the cause of disease. Now, what has been scientifically proved is, for example, the Mater Hospital study in Queensland, Australia, done by the Asthma Foundation of Queensland, showed a 90% reduction of what's called the rescue inhaler and a 50% reduction of the preventative medication by applying the Buteyko method, by retraining the breathing. And I, along with many other people, I totally lost all my symptoms. Now, I had Legionnaire's disease back in the 1970s. So my right lung has COPD and basically doesn't work. My left lung was asthmatic. I now am completely physically active and no longer suffer any symptoms. In fact, Dr. Noble Zeloff was one time asked if this is a cure, And he quoted, what he stated was Ludmila Batenko, who is his mother, had not suffered an asthma attack in 40 years.
Okay, well, let me just add something to what you just said, because we did review the scientific literature, as we always do, when someone's coming on the program with something that is really new, and I found that the scientific literature actually associates an improvement in diabetic conditions, sleep apnea, and some psychological conditions, including anxiety and panic disorders. So I'm absolutely of the belief, based upon looking at the science on this, that imbalances in blood chemistry from improper breathing and basically retraining our breathing habits can eventually help eliminate these asthmatic conditions, along with other stimulations, natural stimulations to the immune system, and also getting rid of allergens, and also like dairy and wheat and sugars that can cause the immune system to be depressed. Final thoughts of taking us through a simple exercise so we can get a more practical idea of how a person retrains their breathing.
Absolutely. Let me tell you what we do with kids, which is great. We tell kids to breathe like they're a little mouse, like there's a big cat that's going to grab them if they can hear their breathing. The first step that Buteyko would say to anyone is reduce your breathing. And so, therefore, breathing through your mouth is incorrect. In fact, when Buteyko would describe his method, he would say chronic hyperventilation is the cause of disease. His second statement would be, are you sensitive to your breathing? If someone said yes, he would say, now reduce it. So one major step that everyone can do is literally breathe less. Don't inhale through your mouth. Don't hyperventilate. And we have a, Gary, we have a self-test on our website, www.ButeykoCenterUSA. And we have a scholarship program, so if someone is not in a position to purchase education on Buteyko, we will gift the material.
Good. That is spelled Buteyko, Buteyko, Center, USA.com. All right, well, thank you very much. I understand you're going to be in New York next week at the Open Center, which is a good place. They do a lot of good work down there. So people can contact the Open Center on East 30th Street, and if they want to have more on this. And for all the people in the audience who have someone who suffers from asthma, adults or children, please look up this information, study it, try it, and see if it makes a difference. And please report back to me, because I'd like to hear your results. I believe it's an important therapy. We have not talked about it before, but I've reviewed the scientific literature, and I believe that we should be paying attention to it. Thanks a lot, Thomas. I appreciate you being on.
Thank you, Gary. We are at the Open Center this weekend, and again, it is an honor to speak with you, Gary.
Okay. Thomas Fredrickson from Woodstock, New York. That's where his center is. Back in a moment with the latest on health and healing. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. I'm Gary Nall. The latest on health and healing. This is from PR Newswire from Silver Springs, Maryland. I'll quote it. Yet another peer-reviewed scientific study proving the connection between the mercury in medicine and human illnesses has just been released. The latest study is the sixth one published in recent months. This report specifically examines the harm inflicted on developing fetuses and children by thimerosal, a mercury-based compound routinely used as a preservative in flu shots. Members of the group Coalition for Mercury-Free Drugs are actively sharing the latest data on the dangers of medical mercury with the public. And thimerosal is the Eli Lilly trade name for sodium mercury, which, when used as a preservative in vaccines and other products, has been shown to be extremely toxic. consisting of approximately 49.6% mercury by weight, thimerosal has been phased out of many vaccines in the United States because of concerns about its potential risk. However, it is still in most flu shots, even though much safer, cost-effective alternatives are already being used. The newest study about thimerosal from the University of Brazil warns that while vaccines are essential to the well-being of children around the world, the use of thimerosal should be reconsidered. The author, Dr. Jose Doria, reviews the published science which demonstrates that infant exposure to the amount of thimerosal in vaccines is toxic to human brain cells. A number of recent studies have further suggested that the mercury used in everyday medical products, such as flu shots, amalgam fillings, which are the dental silver fillings, contributes to causing a wide variety of illnesses, including autism and other developmental diseases in children and Alzheimer's in adults. Now, this is good for those of you who've been using your antioxidants. This is from the Jefferson's Kimball Cancer Center. The scientists there have genetic evidence suggesting that antioxidants currently used in treating lung disease, malaria, and even the common cold could also help prevent and treat cancers because they fight against mitochondrial oxidative stress, a culprit in driving tumor growth. For the first time, the researchers show that loss of the tumor suppressor protein, CAV1, induces mitochondrial oxidative stress in the stromal microenvironment, a process that fuels cancer cells in most common types of breast cancer. Quote, this is from Dr. Lestani, MD, PhD, professor of cancer biology at Jefferson Medical College at Thomas Jefferson University. Now we have genetic proof that mitochondrial oxidative stress is important for driving tumor growth. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Cancer Biology and Therapy. So what this shows is that if you've been using your vitamin C and zinc and N-acetylcysteine and all the other good antioxidants that we talk about, you're helping prevent that cancer from manifesting or spreading in the body. So all along, you were on the right side of history and the right side of science. It just took science a while to catch up. You've heard me mention in the recent programs how dangerous stress and distress are. Here's the latest from Ohio State University, as published in the peer-reviewed journal Brain Behavior and Immunology. Quote, stress can change the balance of bacteria that naturally live in the gut. Quote, these bacteria affect immune function and may help explain why stress dysregulates the immune system. Now, exposure to any form of toxic stress leads to changes in composition, diversity, and number of gut microorganisms, according to the science at the Ohio State University. So in lay language, it means that every time you get upset, and every time you start thinking negative thoughts, and every time you start getting yourself bent out of shape, then you end up disrupting and changing the actual good bacteria in the gut to bad bacteria, and that in turn can cause additional problems. Not a good idea. And finally, for those of you trying to naturally boost your testosterone level, whether male or female, some new information on the raw pine pollen, which is the richest seedbed of testosterone derived from plants. And since it is the male sperm of pine trees, it fosters plush growth in all living creatures, from trees and plants to animals to humans. And some experts claim that the pine pollen is an ingredient in certain pharmaceuticals designed to treat low testosterone levels. Now, low testosterone, as anyone listening to this program already knows, in either male or female populations, can cause an increase in your bad cholesterol. You will definitely prematurely age. You can lose your hair much faster. You'll begin to get sagging and increasing skin. You'll lose bone mass. You'll end up with higher blood sugar levels and decreased aerobic energy. You'll have excess weight gain and you'll have sexual dysfunction. And in men, low testosterone also increases their chance of developing prostate cancer due to a simultaneous increase in estradiol in the body. Now, the reasons for low testosterone in either sex are varied. For men, the largest contributing factors are you're simply eating too much protein, too many fried foods. And by the time you're in your 30s or 40s, you're typically experiencing andropause. Now, that's a term meaning male menopause, or the decline in the synthesis of androgenic hormones, especially testosterone. But we can change that, and we can do it through phytoestrogen intake, meaning your green vegetables, whether juices, the whole food, or their powders. Now in comes the pine pollen. I'll bet you've never heard of pine pollen, but it can provide the opportunity for endocrine hormonal balance in the ratio of testosterone to estrogen within humans, and thus reversing the troubling effects associated with the imbalance that causes quality of life decrease. And this is done mainly through the phytoandrogens in pine pollen, and including testosterone and DHEA and androsterone. And the conditions for diabetes and high blood cholesterol and fatigue have all been improved when, through biological, natural mechanisms, you rebalance your testosterone level. So that's just the latest on something that we're going to hear more about. Mark my words, raw pine pollen. You'll be hearing about it because there's a whole lot out there. And finally, papaya. Papaya has papain, P-A-P-A-I-N. And it's three times more abundant in green papaya than fully ripe papaya. And now, what Christopher Columbus called the fruit of the angels, it's enjoyed all over the place. And every part of the papaya tree and its fruit lends great therapeutic value in maintaining health. And I believe people should be having some papaya or papaya concentrate each day, mainly because of its enzymes. And the ripe fruit provides an enormous amount of enzymes, also some good amounts of potassium. But mainly it's that papain, a formidable enzyme that helps digest protein and reduce inflammation. And the Cacarica papaya, known as pawpaw in Australia and New Zealand, is the most famous species for promoting excellent health and wellness. And we don't get as much of it here, but it's very effective against bacteria, including Staphylococcus aureus and Bacillus cereus and E. coli and Shigella. And the seeds are often rich in the highly digestible protein and contains the alkaloid carpein. And carpein has a calming effect on the heart and the bronchus and the muscles, making it ideal for lung ailments such as bronchitis and asthma. And the natives of the South Sea have long used papaya seeds for birth control and is an effective anti-parasitic. So, papaya for health. Back in a moment with my commentary. Please stay with us.
Looking out on the morning rain, I used to feel so uninspired.
To welcome everyone now for an original commentary. Last evening on MSNBC, Ed Schultz made the following statement, quote, "I call them the Libyan rebels, freedom fighters. Now they are retreating. After all that, does the world community stand by and watch the freedom fighters get crushed? The President Barack Obama pledged that there would be no U.S. troops on the ground, but today we learned that CIA operatives are on the ground. So what does that all mean? Still, it looks like the freedom fighters' only shot for survival at this point is a real injection of military hardware that they say they desperately need. Whether or not we arm rebels, freedom fighters, whatever you want to call them, it's a very hard decision, but I think we have to do it. It is a moral decision at this point. We have a state, New Hampshire, with the motto, live free or die. What do you think that Libyan freedom fighters want?" Unquote, Ed Schultz. I have no problem with Ed Schultz or anyone on the left or the right giving their opinion. That's part of what makes our democracy great in our freedom of speech. My issue is, what happens when we do not step back and think well of the consequences, even the unintended consequences, of our decisions. By extending the logic of Ed Schultz and others, including Rachel Maddow and Lawrence O'Donnell, who have accepted our government's rationale for intervening militarily in Libya, and Ed Schultz's specific beliefs, which mirror those of Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and others on the right, that because Gaddafi was responsible for the bombing of the Pan Am 103 flight over Lockerbie, Scotland, that killed 259 passengers, that we are justified in arming, funding, and training an opposition, any opposition forces in Libya. However, by that same belief, would it not also mean that any civilians and innocent bystanders that were killed, tortured, or disappeared due directly to America's interventions, covertly or not, and the influence and control in other nations throughout our history, would that not justify their being able to accept training and to attack us in their interest, for their redemption and their pain and suffering? This old notion of an eye for an eye, this reactionary posturing, has led us into multiple disasters and wars and regime changes and strategies. And I believe that before any such action, we must stop and ask, is that likely to be the outcome? Who are these so-called rebels and freedom fighters really? Quote, many commentators have voiced anxiety about the mystery which surrounds the anti-Gaddafi transitional government, says Webster Tarpley. The CIA, in an article, the CIA's Libya rebels, the same terrorists who killed U.S. NATO troops in Iraq in 2007, West Point study shows Benghazi, Darna, Tobruk area was a world leader in al-Qaeda suicide bombing recruitments. And here's what it says. The U.S. and other key NATO countries have rushed to the aid of the Libyans, but really shouldn't they be exercising caution to actually try to learn some basic facts about this rebel regime, which is supposedly there to represent a democratic and humanitarian alternative to Gaddafi? The rebels are clearly not civilians, but are armed forces. Many. What kind of armed forces? Since many of the rebel leaders are so difficult to reach from afar, and since the sociological profile of the rebels cannot be done on the ground in this haste and midst of warfare, perhaps the typical methods of social history can be called on for help. Is there a way for us to gain deeper insight into the climate of opinion which prevails in Libya? It turns out there is, in the form of a December 2007 West Point study examining the background of foreign guerrilla fighters, jihadists, mujahideen, including suicide bombers, crossing the Syrian border into Iraq during the 2006-07 time frame under the auspices of the international terrorist organization Al-Qaeda. Now, this study is based upon a mass of about 600 Al-Qaeda personnel files, which were captured by U.S. forces in the fall of 2007. The most striking finding which emerges from the West Point study is that the corridor, which goes from Benghazi to Tobruk, represents one of the greatest concentrations of jihadi terrorists to be found anywhere in the world, and by some measures can be regarded as the leading source of suicide bombers anywhere on the planet. Darna, one of the terrorist fighters sent to Iraq to kill Americans, for every 1,000 to 1,500 persons of population emerges as suicide bomber heaven, especially easily surpassing the closest competitor, which is Saudi Arabia. Now, the West Point report makes it clear that almost one-fifth of all foreign fighters crossing from Syria into Iraq came from Libya. Joseph Felter and Brian Fishman report, quote, Libya contributed far more fighters per capita than any other nationality, and Libyan fighters were much more likely than other nationalities to be listed as suicide bombers. To remind this audience, did we not hear Ronald Reagan and his supporters in the media proclaiming the Contras were similar to America's founding fathers, arming them and training them, when history shows that they were nothing more than criminals, mercenaries, and the former soldiers of Somoza's National Guard? In their West Point report, Fishman and Felter remind us that, quote, the policy of the Reagan White House to arm the Afghan mujahideen with Stinger missiles and other modern weapons turned out to be highly destructive for the United States. As current Defense Secretary Robert Gates comes close to admitting in his memoirs, Al-Qaeda was created during those years by the United States as a form of Arab League, again, against the Soviet presence, with long-term results which have been highly lamented, unquote. So, by supplying Libyan opposition groups with weapons, the Obama administration is in direct violation of the 1973 resolution which called for a complete arms embargo on Libya. Critics argue that the weapons will be used against Gaddafi, and so there is no violation here. However, as in previous conflicts, how can you be sure the weapons will not end up being used against those who supplied them, leading to the loss of more American lives and billions of dollars wasted? Who is Al-Qaeda anyway? History shows that it is a gaggle of fanatics, dupes, psychotics, misfits, double agents, provocateurs, mercenaries, and other elements, unquote. And who funded this group? Who created Al-Qaeda? Quote, the United States and Britain during the struggle against the Soviets in Afghanistan. They emerged from the culture and political milieu of the Muslim Brotherhood. And the Muslim Brotherhood provided an active and capable fifth column for foreign agents against Nasser in Egypt. In the same way, the official website of Al-Qaeda is trumpeting its support for the rebellion against Colonel Gaddafi. Unquote. Let us not forget what history has taught us. As U.S. administrations so often do, quote, political formations in developing countries are often a mask for ethnic and religious rivalries. So it is in Libya. The Libyans' revolution against Gaddafi is a toxic brew compounded by fanatical hatred of Gaddafi and tribalism and localism. From this point of view, Obama has foolishly chosen to take sides in the tribal war, unquote, from Tarpley. Looking at the choices this administration has made, it is becoming clear to me that the Obama method is to use Al-Qaeda inadvertently to overthrow the governments and hence balkanize and partition the countries in question or else use them in ways that benefit us. And I am opposed to that. As recently as February 2004, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, George Tenet, testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that, quote, one of the most immediate threats to U.S. security is from smaller international Sunni extremist groups that have benefited from Al-Qaeda links. They include the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, unquote. Quote, as research suggests, civil wars are not decided solely on the battlefield. The competition between governments and rebels over popular support is far also importance for the outcome of such conflicts. In the case of Libya, popular support for the rebels could lead to further defections of government units, thereby decisively changing the military balance. The question is whether the rebels can create this support on a significant scale. The Libyan rebels appear to be considerably fragmented over political objectives and strategy. It is vital to remember that Libyan politics often equates with tribal politics, loyalty and allegiances running along tribal lines. This is something that might favor Gaddafi, unquote, from Peter Dale Scott. And also the New York Times and the Washington Post both believe that the United States should have begun bombing Libya before the United Nations Security Council approved the mission. A sign that the two preeminent American newspapers continue to side into neoconservatism logic. This neocon attitude, eager for regime change in Muslim countries deemed enemies of Israel, has long dominated the Washington Post with its editorial page under the control of neocon Fred Haidt, with its stable of neocon writers who routinely adopt Likud-like positions regarding the Middle East, unquote, from Common Dreams, Robert Perry, Warriors of Mainstream Media. Now, a little history lesson I believe is necessary to conclude my commentary. And this history lesson is for all of those who would advocate arming individuals before you understand how else we may be able to intervene in a non-threatening way to cause a more positive or constructive outcome. From 1970, and I'm only going back a short ways, to the recent invasion of Libya, we have counted as over 50 direct interventions by the U.S. and other countries that have led to murders, tortures, and severe anti-democratic suppression of populations. Again, I will not go back that far. The number of interventions, not including the two world wars, is over 100. Even while the U.S. was engaged in World War II, we interfered in other foreign countries' domestic politics and elections. While Greece was busy fighting the Nazis, the U.S. took the sides of quasi-fascist elements to defeat the socialist left in a civil war. Ultimately, the fascist groups won, which led to a brutal regime and even the CIA establishing a secret police security agency, the KYP, in Greece, that would become responsible for the systematic torture of left-leaning or progressive dissidents and their murder. The U.S. would again get involved in Greece during the 1967 coup that led to the murder and torture of thousands of Greeks in the name of radical anti-communist paranoia. While both the U.S. and the Philippines were fighting the Japanese militarily, the U.S. simultaneously supported the pro-American regressive powers to subdue the popular leftist Hucks, which led ultimately to the dictatorship of Fernando Marcos. Of course, there are better-known interventions, such as our bombing of Cambodia from 1969 to 74, which led to death and starvation that would cost up to 2 million lives, all innocent civilians. Also, the Karpa bombing of Laos from 1971 to 1973, and George Bush's regime change and overthrow of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Should we forget that our own CIA helped organize the coup in 1963 that murdered Iraq's leader and brought Hussein's Ba'ath Party into power? We created Saddam Hussein. Between 1949 and 1953, the U.S. and the United Kingdom attempted to overthrow Albania's communist government and raise former Nazi collaborators into the government leadership. One of the most notable U.S. interventions, with repercussions still being felt today, was U.S. overthrow of Iran's progressive and democratically elected Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953, who had overwhelmingly been elected. The sole purpose of having him thrown out was Western access to Iran's plentiful oil reserves. In Mossadegh's place, the U.S. along with Britain restored the Shah of Iran, Pahlavi, which would lead to 25 years of systematic repression, torture, and murders of an unimaginable level, all under U.S. tutelage, guidance, training, and arming. There was no democratic opposition allowed in Iran under the Shah's rule. The CIA supported coup to destroy the progressive reformer of Guatemala, Jacob Arbenz, eventually led to 40 years of death squads and the disappearance and death of over 200,000 Guatemalans. Although the U.S. was making the claim that the rationale was to avoid Guatemala swinging into the arms of the Soviet Union, the real reason was that President Arbenz had been nationalizing American and foreign private corporations operating in Guatemala, most notably the U.S. firm United Fruit Company. One of the more deadly coups in which U.S. fingerprints were everywhere was the eventual 1965 military coup of General Suharto in Indonesia. What followed has been called, quote, one of the most savage mass slayings of modern political history, with estimates of executions and deaths reaching over 1 million people. The former Indonesia president, Suharto, was one of the most progressive national leaders of his time, sustaining a neutralist stance against the Cold War by entertaining pro-American as well as pro-Soviet and Chinese sentiments within his country. But with American backing, the Suharto dictatorship commenced on a systematic extermination of any with the slightest association with progressive leftist causes. Later, starting in 1975, the U.S. fully backed Suharto's claim to East Timor. Henry Kissinger personally gave Suharto permission to use U.S. weapons for aggression against a subdued dissent movement, a violation of international law. In 1989, Amnesty International had an estimated 200,000 East Timor citizens, one-third of the entire population, had been victimized. For almost a decade, starting in 1963, the U.S. tried to intervene and overthrow the widely popular, democratically elected socialist Salvador Allende in Chile. After the fascist dictator Alfredo Pinochet's junta took power with blessings from Washington, Henry Kissinger, and even free market economist Milton Friedman, all democracy in Chile came to an end. Pinochet then became responsible for the murder of over 2,500 persons and the torture of 32,000. The famous dirty war in Argentina in the late 1970s and early 1980s led to the military dictatorship's torturing and murdering approximately 30,000 of its own civilians. In Haiti, the U.S. always remained suspicious of the grassroots' popular support of Aristide. In 1991, American support for the military leader, Raul Cedras, forced a regime change, massive civil unrest, and the new U.S.-backed government's repression of pro-democracy voices, leading to 4,000 political assassinations and the fleeing of 40,000 Haitians on boats and rafts to America. For one moment, just consider that in 1989, in order to capture one rogue leader, Manuel Noriega of Panama, our military assault led to the deaths of more than 4,000 innocent Panamanians. I could spend the next 5 hours giving you specific instances of what happens when we arm individuals and support regime change. Ask yourself honestly, do you really believe that arming individuals, where we have one of the largest Al-Qaeda groups in the world, in Libya, and others who are very tribal, would really bring democracy to Libya? Is that the best we can do? I just want to remind you the lessons of history. I'm Gary Nall. I won't have time for your calls today, but we will tomorrow. Joining me in studio now for a different look altogether is Dr. Henry Grayson. Dr. Grayson is a practicing psychotherapist and the founding chairman of the National Institute for the Psychotherapies in New York City. He's also the founding director of the Institute of Spirituality and Science and Psychotherapy and the past president of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. He's also a scholar in East-West Approaches to Mental Health and is the author of important works. He is also heard on the Progressive Radio Network every Wednesday at 4 p.m. with his program, Mindful Living. Nice to have you with us.
Good to be with you, Gary.
I have four areas I would like for you to address, if you would, please. We are constantly hearing of people saying that in the name of love they did something. And then more often than not, they say they were hurt. And then they go back and they redo something. Or they do something that's egregious against another person, frequently violating that person's rights, or mental abuse, verbal abuse, writing, texting, emails, and then come back and say, but I love you, and therefore that should all be behind us. We've got to focus on love. I hear this so often in individuals who are confused. And just yesterday I was counseling a person who said, and this was about a 55-year-old woman, who said, I'm confused. My husband keeps saying that he loves me, and he wants to share true, deep intimacy, and then does things that are completely non-loving. Is it that they're both within the same person, or is there a point to where we have to understand what people say in the name of love is really not love? Because, as this woman says, how can a person use the word love and then turn around and hurt you, and then do it again and again and again? And at what point should I just say enough, or do I never say enough? I just keep forgiving and allowing more to happen. Your thoughts, please. And is this an unusual or an exceptional example that I'm using?
Well, I think that love is probably the most misused word in our language. I think so much of what passes for love is manipulation, it's neediness, it's control, it's desperation, it's trying to get love, more than it is actually love itself. In fact, so much of what we call love is just would be the exact opposite of love. And yet we use that word so loosely all the time. Because how many times in saying I love you to someone are we trying to get them to say it back, for example, and hoping to get it back? Well, that's not real love. That's just hoping to be loved. It's not extending it. One true determination of it, one simple one, is so easy to see. Let me give one example, actually. This woman I talked with some years ago who had a multitude of symptoms and couldn't be diagnosed anywhere. She'd gone to the major clinics, the Mayo Clinic and the Leahy Clinic and those. Finally, she was sent to me to see if we could get to what it was about. And she prided herself in being what she called herself a good Christian woman. She was married to a guy who was doing a medical residency, and he kept complaining that she doesn't love me. She kept saying, well, I'm doing all these things for him, you know, because I love him, you know, and I want to be a good Christian woman in my marriage and loving him. He kept complaining that he didn't feel loved. Her health kept deteriorating. Then one day as she was talking about the things she did for him, I could see a look of tiredness come over her face, and her body began to slump a little bit. That was my first clue. But I think that her trying to be this good Christian woman and love that she was talking about is actually what's killing her and what's destroying the marriage. I thought that's a strange thought to have, but let me explore it. I'd been using muscle testing from applied kinesiology just for a couple of years at that point, which can, I knew that if a body knows something to be true, innermost wisdom knows it to be true, the arm will become strong. And if you know it to be false at that deeper level, the arm becomes weak. So I thought, let me just test this out. And I had her focus on one of those things she was talking about that she did for her husband out of love. And that's to extend her arm and resist me pressing on it. I could have pushed it down with my little finger. It was so weak. This really blew her mind, because normally loving thoughts make your arm very, very strong. And so we began to realize that it was over and over she was doing this. It was destroying her health because she was doing something out of trying to live up to some kind of standard more than it was from the heart.
I see.
It was not love from the heart.
What about individuals who are constantly referring to the dysfunction in their past, men and women, as excuses to why they should be accepted for being hostile, dysfunctional, toxic today, and that because they say, well, my father did this or my mother did that, then you should immediately forgive me for anything I do that is equally egregious, and then turn around and do it again and again and again and again. They never seem to stop using the same techniques, humiliation, degradation, or trying to put you down so that the only way you feel you have any credibility is when they accept you. But if you do not tolerate it, then somehow you're a bad person. I hear this all the time. And I'm hearing it in all generations, including the younger generations, who have mastered the idea of making someone feel so bad about themselves that their only redemption is to acquiesce. I just heard this in a young woman who attended a lecture of mine, who's only 22 years old, and her boyfriend is always putting her down and making her feel stupid and unworthy. Unless she agrees to everything he suggests, then she's okay. But on her own, she's not. Putting people down in order to control them and doing it in the name of love.
Well, people's putting people down may come out of those experiences. But we've all had disturbing experiences as children. Nobody had a perfect childhood.
Right.
Nobody had the perfect love in their lives. And even if we might have had it, we as little kids interpret things in our own ways, and we distort a lot of the things. That's one of the three ways we form our personalities, not just nature and nurture, but how we interpret things. And so that all starts very early. But then if someone uses as justification for cruelty, certainly that's not love. What that person is failing to do is to look inside at oneself. Whereas if we could use others as a mirror instead, to say, whatever I'm criticizing this person for, what I'm putting this person down for, what I'm condemning another person, that's a part of me. I've just not been willing to look at it. And I'm seeing it over there, and I'm punishing it over there, but not willing to look at it as a part of myself. In our human condition, we do so much projecting all the time. It started back even in the religions, where we project our own divine nature on an external God out there somewhere. Then we took this negative part of ourselves and called it an external devil out there. All these are ways that keep us from embracing who we really are and dealing with what's inside us.
What would happen if someone, let's say you were in a relationship, and someone put you down or wrote you toxic emails or left gazillion toxic messages? At what point would you say enough and walk away from it? Or would you? Or would you just continue to forgive that person's aggression?
Well, I think there are two different dimensions about whether you mention forgiveness or whether you stay and be part of that system. Because what I do in my mind is different from what I might do in action for myself. I mean, if a person's being cruel toward me repeatedly, why would I want to stay around that? Why would I want to stay in that if I have the freedom to not be there? Because if I'm loving myself, I'd like to surround myself more with people who are kind and of like manner. But on the other hand, even if I separate myself from that person, then I can cause even more of the problem if I keep holding that grievance against that person who did this to me. Because, as a physicist say, mind is non-local, and whatever's happening in my mind is reaching out and affecting countless others. So if I hold on to that grievance, even though I've separated, if I hold on to that grievance, I'm actually perpetuating the same behavior in the universe all around me. But on the other hand, if I step back, protect myself from being abused, but at the same time have compassionate thoughts that that person will heal, I've seen major changes happen in the other person. I've heard reports back over and over and over again, whether it's a cruel boss, whether it's a cruel mate or ex-mate, you know, whether it's somebody else who's been abusive to them. But if they've been able to see them differently as coming out of that negative place and out of fear and behaving insanely as a result of it, not to pardon it, but to realize that forgiveness, first of all, is just a release mechanism for my own suffering inside. It's not pardoning the sinner. It's to release myself from my own suffering. And in that state, and if I can go into a compassionate thought, first of all, I make myself incredibly strong. I'm really impenetrable then for any of these negative thoughts.
There's someone I know personally, a fella, who was in a recovery program for 10 years. He hadn't had any drugs or alcohol. Then he had this woman get in his life, and within 3 months, his mind was so challenged that he got drunk, went out, started driving, got pulled over, and went to jail for 6 months. I didn't know about this, and he said he was too embarrassed. I wonder where he was, and he said he was too embarrassed to talk to me. I said, but what were you sharing with this person that was so important that you would allow yourself to be so angry that you would go get drunk? Why didn't you say goodbye to the person? He said, because this person was a master manipulator. And said, I later found out that this woman goes into other people's lives and makes herself essential, works on the person's weaknesses, finds out the person's weakness, identifies with the person's weakness, and then exploits them, and always triangulates. This woman's never taken responsibility for any of her actions, but you look behind and there's nothing but a trail of broken lives. And he said he didn't pay attention till afterwards because one of his buddies who also had known this woman had been screwed over said, man, you should have learned. And I said, what was it? Was it the sex? And I'm thinking, he said, yeah. I said, how often do we confuse having sex with someone for giving a person a right than to feel that we are their emotional property, their physical property? And then they use the word love.
Yeah.
Because we've had sex. And this guy, to this day, and this was a year ago, to this day this guy is still, he won't see any woman. And I said, that's stupid. There are wonderful women. Just pay more attention to the energy you're getting. Because
he was
the signs
traumatized
are generally there.
By
yeah, he was totally traumatized. He still is traumatized.
You know, the problem is, though, when we've had a trauma, that information is encoded back in the limbic system, in the hippocampus in particular. And it's just information there that gives a signal off that says, alarm goes off, danger, danger, danger. But if you think about it, our brain is a prototype of the computer. And so if we look at the computer, we see a little bit about how the brain works, though it's much more complex. I mean, brain processes more information than the largest mainframe on Earth. But if we look at the computer, if we don't like a program we have in there, what do? We press a delete button on it. We put in a new program. Now it's actually possible for us to do that ourselves. We don't have to live with these traumas that we've been carrying with us, whether they're traumas like this guy had or traumas from our childhood. There are methods that we can use now, whether they have to do with bilateral stimulation of the brain, whether they have to do with touching on acupressure points, or a variety of other methods, where you can actually do the equivalent of pressing a delete button on those, free ourselves up from that information that makes us react in all these ways, either to deprive ourselves like this man or to be like the perpetrators.
Final two comments. What is love not, and what is love, true love?
Love is not worry. A lot of people confuse those two. I'm worrying about you because I love you. No, it's worry is fear, and fear is the opposite of love. I'm sending forth information and energy that would help harm the person when I'm worrying about them. Love is not jealousy. That's possessiveness. Love is not overprotection. That's weakening a person. Love is not criticizing a person to shape them up because I'm belittling them in that way. I like the definition of Eric Fromm from many years ago in his classic book, The Art of Loving, when he says, mature love has care, respect, responsibility, and knowledge, and is the active striving for the growth and happiness of the loved person. I thought, that says an awful lot.
It does. It's assuming, however, that the person who has taken all the wrong approaches in the name of love will be honest enough with themselves to see that they are responsible for taking something out of context, turning it around, and never learning their own lesson.
They haven't.
So they'll just continue doing the same thing ad nauseum.
The thing we human beings have trouble getting, that if whatever we're doing is taking us into pain and suffering, that's something we need to look at, because we do not have to keep bringing that upon ourselves. And there's something programmed in from the past that we can look at and deal with and let go of, so that we can, each moment, we can choose joy instead of pain. We can choose heaven instead of hell as an existential state moment by moment.
Let's continue this conversation in greater depth next Wednesday when you're on the air. All right, you can come on my program before you go on yours.
Right? Well, I wish I could do that.
Dr. Henry Grayson, and you can reach Dr. Grayson at his website, henrygrayson.com. Have a nice day, everyone.
There's something on my mind. Won't somebody please tell me what's wrong?
The Gary Null Show is produced in our New York City studio. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. The chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Taubenfeld. He's got me smiling.